This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Wa Usalli Wa Usallam Ala Sayyid Al Awaleen Wal Akhireen, Nabiyana Muhammadan, Wa Ala Alihi Wa Sahbihi Wa Barak Wa Sallam. All praise are due to Allah, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad, the Master of the First and the Last, and his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his sunnah to the Day of Judgment. As to what follows, my beloved brothers and sisters, to our viewers, to our friends, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Alhamdulillah, this is the last in our series on pivotal moments in Islamic history. And there are so many pivots that happened in the past that we didn't cover, and so many left for us to cover. But we wanted to have this to be a special class in that we're not looking at the well-known, famous incidents that happened in Islamic history, but we want to look at some phenomena, some things that happened that were of great importance and made a difference to the Muslim Ummah and the world, but are not so well known to the average student of knowledge, and especially to the average individual. And so, in order to do this, we need to reorient our minds to the golden age of Islam. And that went from, you could say, the 7th century to the 15th, 16th century AD, where the Muslims were in a golden age of knowledge. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had blessed the Ummah with the consciousness of Tawheed, of the oneness of God, of the oneness of humanity, and the oneness of knowledge. And so Muslims recognize that all of the knowledge comes from Allah, whether it be sacred knowledge or secular knowledge. It all ultimately comes from the Creator of the heavens and the earth, who has set systems in the universe, systems for the planets to function by, systems for life to be developed, systems within the different types of creatures, the insect world, the animal world, systems within our own bodies. And it is these systems, this infinite amount of information, that really makes up what secular people call science, because really they are gathering the different structures and the different bits of knowledge that Allah put into the world, and they put it together in a science, but they didn't create it. The Creator of the heavens and the earth is something else. And so Tawheed brings it together. It brings together our understanding, and it unites our way of thinking. And so with that as a base, Muslims went out into the world. Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, in his Arafat sermon, he told his followers, those who are present should take this to those who are absent. And so the companions of the Prophet ﷺ saw themselves as ambassadors of Tawheed, that they had to take this message out, and they also had to stand for Tawheed. They had to call to the good and to forbid evil. So many historians look and see that the majority of the companions actually died outside of the Hijaz area, the Mecca and Medina area, because Islam was for the world. It was not just for the Arabs of the Arabian Peninsula. And when the Muslims went out, when they crossed the sands into Iraq, when they went into the high mountains in Yemen in the south, when they went up into Egypt, Mediterranean, far north, they encountered civilizations that had been developing for thousands of years. And instead of destroying everything in sight, like the Mongol invasion, where they would literally burn all the books, and it is said by some reporters that when Baghdad had been conquered in 1258, that at some points in the Tigris-Euphrates, there were so many books that were thrown down into the river that you could literally ride your horse over the books to the other side because of the thickness of the amount of books that they plunged into the river itself. And so Muslims gathered the knowledge and incorporated the knowledge. And that was one of the great contributions of the Abbasid dynasty, in that they developed what was known as Bayt al-Hikmah, the house of wisdom. And in the house of wisdom, scholars were invited from all parts of the world. Knowledge was accepted regardless of the person who was bringing the knowledge. And so by bringing together the theories and the understandings and the knowledge of the ancient ones, Muslims were able to develop precise methodology to be able to structure the sciences, structure the aspects of knowledge in a way that people could benefit from this knowledge in the time period that they were living in. So that was really the Bayt al-Hikmah, because Hikmah means wisdom. The wisdom is not creating something from nothing. It's not magic, but it is the ability to deal with what you have in a relevant, useful way. So many aspects of knowledge were covered in Bayt al-Hikmah, in Baghdad, and also in the great cities of Islam, especially you see in Cairo and North Africa and in Al-Andalus, which is Spain and Portugal. We see that in Granada and Valencia and Cordoba and the great cities of Al-Andalus, Muslims were able to make great strides in knowledge. And one of the areas which is important to our opening of the untold pivotal moments, and that is when the golden age of thinking touched astronomy. Now, Muslims were naturally oriented towards direction, because in order to pray, we need to know Qibla. So we need to know which direction is Mecca. So wherever you are, you need to know this. And there was a time when we didn't have cell phones and we would carry around compasses with us. And because we needed to know wherever we were, which direction to face in order to make our salat. And so it was natural for Muslims to now develop precise methods in understanding direction, understanding the universe itself. And that was different than astrology, because astrology is seeking from the knowledge of the stars and the planets and the universe. It's seeking type of magic. So astronomy is the natural science. And just by making salat, Muslims were oriented toward this. Also, in making the pilgrimage to Mecca, Muslims needed to have maps. So they needed to have some way to get from one point to another, because, for instance, if you were coming from the high areas of India or Tibet or high in the Caucasus Mountains or Afghanistan, you need to come down mountains, through passes, crossing deserts, to the side of the oceans, over to Mecca, to a desert again. You need to have direction. And even in the modern world that we are living in, we have direction. Now, many years ago, they used to have books, triptychs. Now you have your Google Maps, you have your Waze, which can actually lead you to a place. That's a guide. And if you're getting a complicated, a higher level version of these Google Maps and the ways, it actually tells you, it shows you on the way where you can get gas, where you can eat food, where you can have a place to stay. So that is like your guide that you're carrying with you. In those days, with no cell phones, people needed to have a guide. How do you cross this desert? Where is the best place to get water? Who are the most friendly people on the way? And so this is where Muslims started to excel in geography. So astronomy, geography, and everything needed. And so the astrolabe, quadrants, sextants, compasses, these are developed by Muslims. These compasses, in the picture, I picked them up while I was in the country of Oman in Muscat. And I visited the home of a great seafarer, Abu Ahmed, and he took me to his house. And his family heirloom that they passed down, some people passed down swords, some passed down Quran, some passed down jewelry. Because the Omanis were seafaring people, his parents passed down to him huge compasses and quadrants that they could use on their boats that the Omanis would take on the ocean. So astronomical instruments. Muslims developed and made great contributions. They cataloged maps and visible stars. They corrected sun and moon table. they were the first to use the pendulum to build observatories. The invention of the sundial, that's in the 11th century. Muslims predicted sunspots, eclipses, comets. Some of the famous astronomers were Ibn Yunus, Al-Farghani, Al-Battani, Al-Biruni, Ibn Rushd. These are great scholars, and this is how their scientific texts would look like. So now you see Arabic there, and now you see mathematical equations and maps. This is literally a Muslim scientific textbook. Now, the pivotal moment in the age of golden understanding, when the Muslims were leading the world, this is what I call the age of exploration. So now, with this ability to travel, with the compasses there, with the books that are being written, with the long distances in the Muslim Ummah, it was a chance for Muslims to do what other nations could not do. Because when you travel out of your continent, out of your people, you may run across hostility. But if a Muslim crosses, then yes, there's hostility on the road. But if you get to another Muslim center, then you will find people who are united with you, with their understanding of God, and also with their general knowledge. And so these travel logs, these geography books, are of crucial importance to us in unlocking the age of exploration. And this that you see on the right is a map. This is Al-Idrisi, who is a very famous geographer, historian, scholar. And he actually did a globe for the king of Sicily. And this is back like 13th century. And this is a map. And if you were able to understand what this map is, then you'll see that it looks like it's sort of upside down. Because Muslims had a different understanding of the world. We today are thinking in Eurocentric terms. We think that north is positive, or it's developed, and south is underdeveloped. We say that the north is like the first world, and the deep south is the third world. But Muslims had the opposite. They were Mecca-centric. They were based in Mecca itself and recognized that knowledge, human knowledge, came from the south. The first human beings came out of the south and then traveled north. Similarly, knowledge traveled from south to north. And to give you an example, this is another map here, and this is a map done by Al-Mas'udi. And you'll see in the Arabic that is there, it's 957. 957 that he drew this map. And he put on the map, in the Arabic it says, Ard Majhula, unknown territory. And so, again, the map is actually what we would call upside down. So let me turn it around for you. So if you look to the left of the map, you'll see the wide territory. I don't have a pen to actually show you, but you'll see where Africa is. It's to your left center. And then you'll see Arabia. And go around, you'll see India, Indonesia. Go around to the top, Russia. Then you'll see Scandinavia, right? Is it coming clear to you now? Then you'll see Spain. Okay, so now Africa is there. And below Africa, there is a huge mass of land. And this is called unknown territory. So therefore, in 957, Muslims knew that there was land across the Atlantic. This is long before Christopher Columbus. It was known and it was put on the map, but it was given its proper understanding because they did not know who was living there. There were people there, but they were honest enough to say that they didn't know. So amongst these important geographical texts is the text of Al-Mas'udi. And that's his book in 956, 957. He wrote a book. His actual book was in 956. And this is called Muruj al-Dhahab wa ma'adan al-jawhir. And al-Mas'udi was called the Imam of the historians. So he's not just a historian. He was called by the historians their leader. And he actually traveled. He didn't just write. He went on long journeys himself. So he was experiencing and he was recording. And this is a very important text, which opens up one of the untold pivotal moments. In the 11th century, Al-Idrisi, who did that map that we saw, Kitab al-Mamalik wal-Masalik. So this is the book of the kingdoms and of the journeys into the kingdoms. In the 14th century, Al-Umari did the work Masalik al-Abra fi Mamalik al-Amsa. And that is the journey of enlightened people into the kingdoms of the cities and the countries of the world. Okay, so these are very important points, very important texts. In 1517, Piri Rais, who was a great historian, geographer, and he served under the Ottoman Empire, and Sultan Selim I was the leader at the time, the Khalifa for the Muslims, and Piri Rais gave him a handbook of nautical maps. Okay, and this was made up of 219 detailed charts from over 200 years. So what the Ottomans were able to do, because they conquered many lands, they gathered together the maps and the information, they codified it, and Piri Rais was able to make a handbook out of it. And this is amazing because it's 1517 now. This map, if you could see closer onto the map and look at it, this is actually South America. So if you were at the top, Guyana, for those of you who may be Guyanese, would be right at the top, not in the picture. Right here would be right at the end of Suriname and, you know, the French Suriname, and then going down into what is now Brazil. And if you follow the map down, you will see it's actually giving you the Brazilian coast. 1517. Now, if this is the Brazilian coast, and when they looked at the longitude and latitude later on, they found out that it was almost perfect. How could Piri Rais, in 1517, have a map that showed the latitude, the longitude, the detailed coast, South American coast, if Columbus discovered the Americas in 1492? That's like 25 years. How is it not possible? It's not possible. So this is hard evidence. This is an untold story. And we have hard evidence to show that Muslims and other peoples were in the Americas. There was contact being made across the lands. And this takes us to one of the journeys again, because we're looking at the journeys. And these are subjects that you can study if you have a chance, do some research. One important journey is the journey of Mansa Musa. He was a great emperor of Mali in West Africa, and he's considered to be the richest person who ever lived. Now that might sound strange to you. This is a black African Muslim leader in the 14th century. How could he be richer than Bill Gates? How could he be richer than the Nizam of Hyderabad, or the famous rich people in the world today? Jeff Bezos, how is that possible? Google it. Put in, who is the richest man who ever lived? That's not a Muslim Google. And when you put it in, you will see Mansa Musa, pound for pound, was the richest person who ever lived on earth. Because the gold, they were mining gold the size of grapefruits. So literally every place that he went, and he made his pilgrimage to Mecca in that year, he changed the economy of every country that he reached. And as he moved across Sahara Desert, you're going West Africa, going up into North Africa, across, You're crossing the Sahara Desert. And he carried with him over 65,000 people. Some say 72,000 people traveled with him on his pilgrimage to Mecca. So as he was moving across, changing the economy, and finally they reached into Egypt. And Al-Umari, remember that book that we looked at, one of your great geographers, his informant sat with Mansa Musa. And he said, where did you get this power from? And Mansa Musa said, I got it from my older brother, my predecessor, Abu Bakr. Mansa, meaning king, Abu Bakr. And he explained that there was great cities of knowledge. There was the city of Timbuktu that by the 16th century had 25,000 students in its university. These are black African Muslim universities in West Africa. It was an amazing thing. And Al-Umari writes in his work in Arabic. We have it up until today. It's been translated too into French and English. Al-Umari mentioned the Americas, that there was journeys across the ocean. This is an untold story with hard evidence. And Al-Umari spoke about Mansa Abu Bakr, who had the wealth like Mansa Musa, remember, richest man who ever lived. He heard about land across. Remember, out of Majhula, it was on the map. So he wanted to find this land. And so he went out with a flotilla of over 2,000 ships, 1,000 for his men, 1,000 for their supplies, and they went into the ocean, and they never came back to Mali. Now, when you look at the map here, you will see West Africa, and look at the distance between West Africa and South America. You see, that's different than North America and Africa or Spain. This is the closest point you can get for land. And if you look at your map, you will also see these lines that are being drawn. These are the currents, the equatorial currents. And you see the current is like a force in the ocean. And Mansa Abu Bakr described it. They said it was like a river in the ocean. And the boats that got on it, they got pulled away. One went, came back, and he took 2,000 ships. They got onto the river. You don't need sails. So if you follow this current here from West Africa, it will take you directly into Brazil. You go north into Barbados, into the Caribbean region. You don't need sails. It's a natural way to get across. 2,000 ships. This is contact that was made. The Muslims, African people, and the people in the Caribbean and Brazil. But many people would say, no, like we don't accept this story because there's no Europeans who agree. But in the 60s, a Norwegian scientist named Thor Heyerdahl, he actually had boats made from indigenous African material. And he sailed from Safi in Morocco, and he went all the way across, and he landed in Barbados. And that is his boat, the Ra II, okay, done by a European, taking the currents. So it was definitely possible for those who needed to have Eurocentric authenticity. In Brazil and across the Amazon, there have been found the writing Mandinka inscriptions. These are inscriptions made by African people found in Peru and in Amazon, going across South America, right into Central America, up to Panama, into Mexico, and even into the United States. And Leo Weiner, a Harvard University scholar who wrote a book called Africa and the Discovery of America, showed how these Mandinka Muslims actually reached the United States, and they intermingled with the First Nations indigenous people. So this is an amazing story. And hard evidence again, there is a European scholar. He based himself in Mexico City, and he wrote a book called Unexpected Faces in Ancient America. And this, he had a display that was in Mexico City in the museum's public, and he was showing the sculptured heads before Columbus that was in Mexico and in Central America. And if you look at this particular one that he found, you will see that it's got scarification. So this was being done by West Africans. But look at, he's got a turban and a cap. This is typical Muslim dress. So this is in Mexico before Columbus. This is hard evidence of the presence of Muslims in this area. And the people of Panama, the people of Central America actually traced their lineage, some of their lineage, back to these African Muslims who actually came across. This is an untold story. And it's a pivot. It's because these Muslims are now making contact internationally. And quiet as it's kept, this is why so much was done on an international level. Another important person in these untold stories that came out of this same golden age of Islamic knowledge was a great Chinese admiral named Chen Hua. Now they spell it with a Z or Z, but the pronunciation Chen Hua, who lived, this is from 1371 to 1433 or 35, okay? So he was a famous Chinese explorer, diplomat, admiral, and it was during the Ming Dynasty. This is one of the famous dynasties in China itself that he became famous. His name was originally Ma He, and he came from a Muslim family. Now, if you know China itself, you will see that it is made up of so many different nations. And to the set in the center of China, and also if you go to the northwest, you will see Turkic Mongolian people. Many of these Turkic nations, as we have found out in our pivots, became Muslim. And relations, diplomatic relations, trade relations, were held between the Muslims and the Chinese dynasties. So this is the Ming Dynasty now. And Chen Hua, he rose in the ranks. Now, it is said that, you know, to actually get his story, he was the great-great-grandson of Sayyid Ajal Shamsuddin Umar. And he was the governor of the Yunnan province, and it was being controlled by the Mongols at that time. And the Ming Dynasty now comes in, fights off the Mongols, a struggle is going on, and conquest is happening. So his grandfather had the title Haji, and his father actually had the title Haji. And this points to the fact that they more than likely made Hajj. They made pilgrimage. So these are Chinese Muslims. They're in the area now known as China, but they are Muslims. Now, in the struggle between the Ming Dynasty and the Mughals of the Yunnan area, his father died. And so Ma He was captured. And he was taken into the court of the leader. And it is said, you know, that he had a big appearance. So he was strong. And he was tall. And some descriptions say that when he grew to his final height, he was 7 chi tall. That's about 11 inches. So he was about 6'4". Now, 6'4" for a Chinese person, at that, even today, 6'4" in China is really big. And you'll see a couple Chinese who made it to the NBA basketball. But the average height of the people there in the continent, you know, they're short. So in those days, just imagine back there in the 14th century, 6'4" is a giant. And it also said that he was 5 chi in circumference. So he was 4.5 feet around his waist and his stomach. This is a giant of a man. And he's described as having piercing eyes, teeth like shells. His voice was like a bell. So he's an imposing character. And when the conquering Ming people captured him and they said, "Where is your leaders?" And he said, "The leader jumped in the lake." So they captured him, not killing him because maybe they could use him. Because remember, slavery was an worldwide institution at the time. And so they captured Mahé, put him in the court, and after a period of time, they castrated him. And this is something that was being done by different empires and kingdoms when they wanted somebody to work in their harems or to work close. They would castrate the person, keep him alive, and then give him another life. So Mahé was castrated, but he was so imposing. He rose in the ranks until he reached the level of being considered as the admiral of the Chinese imperial fleet. So this is something that is serious. Because what it means is that he is the admiral of this fleet, and this fleet, when it went out, the fleet had 317 ships. Think about this now. 317 ships, 28,000 sailors was in the fleet. So when they come into town, this is a huge thing. This is a worldwide phenomenon. This is something that every person on earth should study about. Think about this. How many people know about Columbus? Three ships he traveled, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. But go around the world and they know Columbus so-called discovered America in 1492, which was a lie. Okay, this is Mahé now, Cheng Hyo, who becomes the admiral. And he went on a number of journeys. This is 28 years, 1405 to 1433. And he covered 50,000 kilometers. Okay? He had the greatest navy in history at the time. And if you pound for pound, proportionately, it would be the greatest navy up until now. And this is the Chinese glyphs, the writings for his name. He's an amazing person. And this is an artist's conception about what Chen Huo might have looked like. Very imposing person. Strong, glaring eyes. He was a master of warfare. He was a master of sciences. He was the great general. And when the Chinese had the Olympics a little while ago there in Beijing, and you know you have the cultural part of the Olympics, they brought out a float with the boat of Cheng Huo. That's how important it is in Chinese history. But they didn't say in the float that he was a Muslim. They didn't say that. That would have been a shock to a lot of people if they knew that Cheng Huo was actually a Muslim. Now, look at the comparison between Cheng Huo's boat and the Christopher Columbus's boat. You have to now fix your eyes. Look at the little boat down in the middle. See the little boat? That's the Nina of Christopher Columbus. Look at the size of Cheng Huo's boat. Okay? This is the journey that everyone in the world is supposed to know about. Right? This journey changed history. It's an untold pivot in history. And when they came into town, this is an artist's conception, when they're coming into town, when they're moving into your port, this is something serious. People have never seen anything like this before. With 317 boats coming in, coming into your shores. So with this, he traveled the Pacific Ocean, even the Western Pacific. He traveled the Indian Oceans, all China Sea, Indian Ocean. There's even discussion about him going all the way across the Pacific. Okay, what did he do? First, it was a diplomatic mission. He was making connections between the peoples of the regions that he went to and the Ming Dynasty. And in some cases, he would actually facilitate envoys to return with him back to China to meet the Ming Dynasty leadership. And so it was diplomatic. It was also trade. So he would bring, they would carry with them porcelains and silk and different gold and silver. And they would receive, based on that, they would get ostriches, especially from Africa, zebras, camels, ivory, giraffes, all types of gifts that were being given by the people. And they traveled to Brunei, Java, Thailand, Southeast Asia, India, the Horn of Africa. He went to Mogadishu, right, Somalia. He went into Yemen, right? All of these areas. Did you ever hear of a Chinese admiral going to Yemen or going to Somalia? No. And it was shocking at the time because when he was in East Africa, and there, you know, he went along the Horn of Africa and down into now the Swahili coast to Mombasa, you know, Malindi, Lamu, into this area there. And he visited the town of Kilwa. There's only ruins left in Tanzania now of Kilwa. And it was described by anybody who reached in this area as one of the most beautiful cities in the world. So this is what's left of Kilwa itself up until today. But he reached down this area, and I even saw a documentary where there are people living on the coast there in the Pate Islands, and you know, they're on the coast of Kenya, Swahili coast, who are part Chinese. So they say that they are descendants of Chen Hyo's people, who stayed for a little while, intermarried, right? And they are the part Swahili and part Chinese. So he strengthened the relationships of the people of this region. And another thing that he did is that he brought order to the whole of Southeast Asia. Because during these journeys, he would ruthlessly destroy pirates. So anybody who was threatening trade routes, and that's really important on the islands of Indonesia. You go up Malaysia, the Malacca Straits, and then over into the area of Bangladesh and down into Oman and all along that region there and going to China. He brought order to the region and organized it. And this was a world event, a world-class event. It's a pivot point. And it's a great Muslim leader who is actually the leader of this event. So this is another one of our great heroes, Chen Hyo. The third that I wanted to look at today is Ibn Battuta. And Ibn Battuta, whose actual name was Abu Abdullah Muhammad Ibn Abdullah Al-Lawati At-Tanji. And he was born in 1304. He was generally known as Ibn Battuta. It's interesting because Ibn Battuta actually means the son of, it's like a little duck, a duckling, this bat. So Battuta in their language, you know, in sort of Arabicized language, so, you know, so it was like a nickname that Ibn Battuta was given. But his name was Muhammad Ibn Abdullah. And he was born in the area of Tanja, of Tangiers, modern-day Morocco. He grew up in a scholarly family. And once he had completed his basic studies, and he was faqih in Maliki fiqh, he also studied the Shafi'i fiqh as well. So once he got his studies together, you know, then he began a series of journeys. His original intention was to make Hajj. He's like 20 years old and, you know, he wants to just to get out. And he wants to make his Hajj. He wants to see Cairo. He wants to see Mecca and Medina. He wants to see Damascus. Open his horizons like many young men would want. And so he began his journey. And this picture here, I actually took this picture myself. And this is in Tanja, in Tangiers, Morocco. So this is what is left of the actual place where he was born, there in Tanja. They fixed it up, of course, but this would be his alleyway, and they still keep it, you know, as a type of museum, you know, for the home of Ibn Battuta. He's such an important traveler. Ibn Battuta, he went across North Africa, the Middle East, East Africa, Central Asia, you know, Southeast Asia. I would consider him, and many people consider him, to be the greatest traveler who ever lived. Now, Europeans talk about Marco Polo. But really, if you look at the journey of Marco Polo, which is disputed by a lot of people, and the journey of Ibn Battuta, you know, went further than him and had deeper experiences and was able to catalog it in a better way. And he has actually done a book. It's generally known as the Rihla Ibn Battuta, but it's called A Gift to Those Who Contemplate the Wonders of Cities and the Marvels of Traveling. So this is a gift that he is giving to you. And he totaled in his travel 117,000 kilometers, 73,000 miles. This is in those days, right? Think about this. He went further than Chen Hua, okay, who was about 50,000, about 31,000. He went further than Marco Polo, who was only 15,000. Okay, now this is an untold story. It's a Muslim traveler, right, coming in the golden age, you know, of Islam. But you don't hear about this. And it's an amazing story. This is an artist's conception, even of Ibn Battuta. But he must have been a very imposing type of person, charismatic kind of person, because he was able to gain the attention and gain the trust of people everywhere that he went. So his first journey was to make Hajj. And he made the pilgrimage to Mecca. That was in 1325, 21 years old, set off. He had some difficulties on his way, but made it across North Africa. He went south in Egypt, but there was a revolt happening. It was the time of the Mamluks, and there was a revolt happening down in the south. He had to go back north, and eventually he had to go to Damascus. So in Damascus, he found a caravan, and then he went down into Mecca and Medina, and he made his pilgrimage. Now, normally, that would be enough, because 16 months of traveling in those days, Ibn Battuta did not return home for 24 years. He never returned home. And he continued on his journey. And this is a artist's conception of the maps of the travels of Ibn Battuta. And this is amazing. And if you follow the different colors there's a red color, there's an orange color, there's a maroon color. These are the journeys that he was actually taking as an individual. This is amazing because how much gold? He doesn't have a credit card. Okay? How much gold can you carry with you? So he's got to survive off his wits. He survives off interaction with the peoples that he comes to. And he's able to move from place to place. So what he did on his first journey was that, you know, he went up into Damascus and around in those areas. And then he went into Iraq, over into Isfahan, into Shiraz, which is now present-day Iran, up into Tabriz, right? All of those areas. And he went into the area of the Ilkhanate. Now, you remember how the Mongols had divided the Golden Horde, right? And then the Ilkhanate of Hulagu, right? And then the major group of the Mongols in China. So he entered into Tabriz. Tabriz was the capital of the Ilkhanate. And he was such an imposing character that immediately he was taken to the court of the Mongol leader, who was impressed by him. And everywhere he went, he was so knowledgeable and charismatic that they wanted him to be the Qadi. So they wanted him to be the judge, because he had mastered Maliki fiqh, also Shafi'i fiqh. And the Shafi'i fiqh was spread into so many different areas. Maliki fiqh, you know, was also a good base. And so he traveled around in these areas. And from there, he returned back and he made another Hajj. He went down into Yemen, into that area, and then he traveled down into East Africa. So he went to Somalia, Mogadishu, he went down into Mombasa, he went to Kilwa. And this is where he described Kilwa as a beautiful town, one of the most beautiful, organized cities he's ever met in his journey. This is East Africa, okay? Present-day Tanzania, if you ever get a chance to go there, you can see it. Now, from 1332 to 1347, he made Hajj for the third time. And then instead of going home, he went north. He wanted to go north. So he ended up going into Anatolia. So that is the present-day Turkiya and Antalya. And he went around to Erzurum. And it's interesting because he wanted to go to Constantinople. He went north into this area of Siberia. He wanted to go to Constantinople, okay? Because the Muslims had not conquered Constantinople at that point. It was the time of Orhan Bey. Now remember, we studied the Turks in our pivotal moments. So this was the time of Sultan Orhan Bey of the Ottoman Empire. And he made it to Iznik, which was Nicaea. And he wasn't able to meet Orhan because he wrote that Orhan had 100 forts and he was constantly moving around, taking care of his territories. But he met the wife of Orhan and he said she was a gracious Muslim woman. She treated him kindly. He ended up going on to Constantinople itself. And there he met Andronicus III, who was the Roman Empire, Byzantine Roman Empire. This is how impressive he was. He actually met the emperor. And from there, he traveled back down. He went east to Bukhara and to Samarkand. He loved Samarkand and all of this area there. Then he returned down to Afghanistan. And then he went over to India. Now, by that time, most people would be finished. He continued, and he went down into India, and you'll see this trip that he made, and he met there in India the Sultan Muhammad ibn Tughluq. Now, this is another Mongol leader of the Mughals, and he was considered to be the richest person in the Muslim world at the time. And Ibn Battuta was so charismatic, he was so influential, that Sultan Muhammad wanted him to be his Qadi. So he took him on as the chief judge of Delhi in India itself. And he stayed there for a period of time. He even got married. But eventually he wanted to travel because one of his goals was China. So he eventually was able to leave India. He went to what is now Pakistan, to the Maldives, in the Indian Ocean, and got a boat, and he went up into China. And finally there, moving around from place to place, he met Muslim Chinese who were there, even somebody who was from North Africa. And he was able to travel around into China and record this information, and then he started to make his way back home until he reached back to Morocco. Now, when he reached Morocco, he found out that his mother and father had passed. So there was nothing left really to hold him. And so he went north into Al-Andalus to struggle with the Muslims, because it is said that Gibraltar was being captured. So he went to struggle, but Alfonso did not make it there. And so he continued on to Valencia and Granada. And he writes about this. Then he went south. And because he's such a traveler, and he hadn't seen parts of his own country, so he went down into Marrakesh, and then he went south to Sijil Massa, and he crossed the Sahara Desert to the Mali Empire. And there, he actually met Mansa Suleiman of the Mali Empire. This is before Mansa Musa. And he said that, you know, he never saw people so interested in reading the Quran. And he said the beautiful clothes that they had, you know, the West African riga, you know, that the people had. Meticulous. He said they were meticulous at teaching their children the Quran itself. Some of their habits he didn't like bowing down too much, you know, to the leaders. And, you know, he made his criticisms, but he said it was the safest place he had ever been in all of his journeys. He did not have to worry about any robbers on the road. And he wrote about this, you know, in his Rihla. A message came to him while he was in the town of Gao, which is there in Mali today, from the Sultan of Morocco, Al-Maghrib, that he must return. So he returned to Tanja and put his writings, sat down with the scribes, gathered information from other books, put it together until he had a series of his journeys, the Rihla of Ibn Battuta, rahimahullah. So this is another game changer. This is an important person. This is a pivotal moment for us because it opens our mind to history. You know, there is some discussion that Chen Hua, the Chinese emperor, actually made it to America itself. And a person by the name of Gavin Menzies, and he wrote a book, 1421, the year China discovered America. He's proving that Chen Hua made it into South America because they had the boats, right? They had enough. And he's trying to prove this from that side. And there's remnants there of Chinese presence, even on that. So this is a game changer, a pivotal moment for the whole of the world. And again, as the Quran tells us, that, you know, in their stories, there is certainly lessons for men of understanding. لَقَدْ كَانَ فِي قَصَصِهِمْ عِبْرَةً لِأُولِ الْأَلْبَابِ. And so I want to open up the floor for any questions that anybody may have concerning this untold pivot, the final in our series for this semester. And these are stories we can continue to research, look it up, get the documentaries, and open up the doors of untold understanding. So I want to open up the floor. Are there any questions that anybody may have concerning our travelers and those who are traveling on the oceans around the world? Floor is open for any questions.
I have a question online.
Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum. Did Ibn Battuta ever get close to the Americas? What was his primary mode of travel?
Ibn Battuta did not go to the Americas. Ibn Battuta mainly went North Africa and then Arabia, East Africa. He went up into what's now Turkey, up in, near Siberia, India, then down into Southeast Asia, and then around up into China, right? So and then back to Morocco, was his base, and then down into West Africa, and to Al-Andalus. But Ibn Battuta never made it to the Americas. You know, his main mode of transportation, he would travel any way that he possibly could. He would ride a horse, he would ride a donkey, he would ride a camel, he would take a boat. Any possible way that he could move, you know, he would move. He would walk if he had to. He would climb. This is a resolute person. Just imagine what he had to go through. And if you read his Rihla, some of the boats crashed, almost sunk. He was captured a number of times by robbers. He had to escape from criminals on the road. But he was intrepid. He was charismatic. And he had this personality that just impressed people. And he was able to gain confidence. And he worked for his living because he was a faqih. And he actually established Islamic law in the Maldives, the Maldive Islands off India. He actually established Islamic law there because they wanted him to be the Qadi. And actually, he went too far for them because he was saying he wanted the women to dress, you know, better, and, you know, he wanted, you know, punishment for the thieves. And, you know, he was trying to implement Islam in a majority Muslim area. It was a little bit too heavy, and so he eventually left the Maldives. But he worked for his living because Muslims, he traveled in Muslim societies, and he was also a diplomat, an ambassador, an envoy. He did so many things, you know, to earn his living. Okay, so the floor is open for any other general questions that anybody may have.
Assalamu alaikum. Does China recognize Chenghu as a Muslim?
The question is, does China recognize Chenghu as a Muslim? The time of the Olympics, they brought out his boat, but they didn't really say that he was a Muslim itself. But in China itself, the Chinese Muslims, there are masjids in Beijing, and he is known. His story is known in China. I don't think it's put into the main Chinese textbooks. But amongst the Chinese Muslims and those, you know, who study, they would know that he is a Muslim. But it's not popular knowledge, unfortunately. Yes, so Islam reached the Americas before Columbus. I have a book called Deeper Roots, and you can get this text from my website. My website is www.hakimquick.com. So go to this website, and you can get my book Deeper Roots, where I can bring you the proofs to show Muslims in America before Columbus and other texts, you know, that are there. There is documented proof. Now, so this will be the conclusion of this semester of our classes on pivotal moments. To continue this journey that we are constantly, to my Facebook page, Sheikh Abdullah Hakim Quick. It's public figure. Instagram, Abdullah.Quick. I'm on Instagram as well. Of course, the website, HakimQuick.com. You can also continue to follow and get more lessons out of the Islamic Institute of Toronto's website, which is islam.ca. So there you can go back. If you didn't get all of this series, you can go back, you can join and, you know, come on, and you can get some of the other tapes for the other pivotal moments and other bits of information from the Islamic Institute, you know, of Toronto. We also will continue our classes at islam.ca. And that will be our new Muslim corner, which will be on Fridays. Inshallah, we'll try to go through the summer as much as we possibly can. That's Friday evenings at 7:30. Friday evenings, you can come on. We're studying the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, for new and revived Muslims. So I leave you with these thoughts. And if anything you've gained out of this, this is from Allah. The mistakes are mine. And I ask Allah, you know, to forgive me and to have mercy on me and you. I leave you with these thoughts. Aqulu qawli hadha wa astaghfirullah li wa lakum. Allahumma salli ala sayyidina Muhammad fil awwalin wa salli alayhi fil akhirin wa salli alayhi fi kulli waqtin wa heen wa salli alayhi fil mala' al a'la ila yawmiddin wa akhir da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.